Delta variant of the virus is surging in Florida and renewed concern about the spread of the disease. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a look at the renewed urgency to get Jacksonville vaccinated against COVID-19. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, author Anne McCutcheon. Also, the latest into the condo collapse in Surfside and what it means for our coastal buildings. But first this hour, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry on Twitter yesterday urged people who have not yet gotten the shot to be vaccinated against COVID-19. At the same time, WJCT News has learned health systems and community organizations across the city are planning to collaborate on a new full-scale vaccination push beginning next month, we hear. All of this as more and more cases of the Delta variant of COVID-19 begin to crop up nationwide. Health experts in Jacksonville say they're seeing a growing number of infections linked to the variant. In fact, they say it's practically a perfect storm. Not the news we needed practically a year and a half into this pandemic. But we do have an update right now from Chad Nielsen, Director of Infection Prevention at UF Health Jacksonville. Chad, great to have you back on the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And as we talk about the Delta variant surging in this community, give us a call because we want to hear from you out there. If you haven't been vaccinated, why on earth are you hesitating? Public health experts are begging people to get vaccinated. So please give us a call as we talk about this. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Chad, what's going on at your COVID ward and at UF Health and at the other hospitals around this community?
Yeah, so we are seeing a surge of COVID-related hospitalizations here at UF Health Jacksonville, as well as around the other community hospitals. In fact, we're seeing anywhere from a 10 to 15% rise in cases in our hospital admitted per day. And that's very alarming that we're moving in such a quick direction. This is very reminiscent of what we were seeing back in January during the winter surge.
Right. And it's this variant, isn't it? It's more contagious, even more so than the original virus.
That's what we're thinking at this point. Because the state is still withholding or at least not communicating Delta variant information as much as we'd like, we are assuming that this rise in cases is due to the variant, which does spread quicker amongst the unvaccinated population.
Right. I mean, the state is only giving out weekly case numbers now. They used to give them out every day. So it's hard to get a grip on this. But that said, what are your thoughts about Mayor Curry yesterday urging people to be vaccinated? It might be a little late in the game to be putting that message out with such urgency, but it's certainly welcome, I would think, among public health officials such as yourself.
Absolutely. Mayor Curry has been very receptive to the public health experts here in the community, as well as the hospital CEOs. So we're very glad that he put that message out there. It can't be stated enough, particularly as Northeast Florida is now considered a CDC hotspot for COVID-19, including about a 6-county region around us. It's more important than ever that people do get vaccinated.
What does that mean, hotspot? Just a higher case count than average?
Yeah, that's correct. It means that cases are gaining more rapidly here, county by county, than in other parts of the state. And that hotspot right now includes all Northeast Florida counties, Duval, St. John's, Clay, Baker, Nassau, and Bradford. And that's largely amongst counties that have average or low vaccination rates. Baker County itself has less than 30% of their population right now vaccinated, and they're seeing a 267% change in increase in cases over the last 2 weeks. So our hospital at the north side of town near the airport is filled with patients from Northeast Florida, particularly around the Georgia-Florida line, because these are low vaccine counties and they're just pouring into our hospitals.
We'll go to your calls in a moment. 549-2937. Apparently, the virus is really spreading in the jail, the Duval County Jail. 103 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in corrections facilities. in our area. And Chad Nielsen, we are hearing that hospital systems, community-based organizations are talking amongst themselves, and they plan a full-scale collaborative campaign to urge vaccination in this community beginning next month. Can you talk a little bit more about this? Hospital systems working together to try to save more lives a year and a half almost into this mess.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been working as a coalition of hospitals here in Northeast Florida since really the start of the pandemic. And at the front end, it was sharing information, census information, PPE information and supplies. And so we've been maintaining that relationship with our fellow hospitals because we are all in this fight together. And so moving forward, our hospital did receive federal grant funding in order to put programs in place in the community and with our other partner hospitals to educate to the vaccination campaign, particularly in areas of low vaccination rates. And so some of that news and information will start coming out soon about what those events look like.
You know, and we've heard that sometimes you have people coming into the hospital needing oxygen, because let's be clear, you're not going to the hospital with COVID unless you can't breathe. You go to the hospital when you need oxygen. And we've heard anecdotally that some patients are coming in, Chad, saying that they really didn't believe that they needed the vaccine, that they thought it was overblown, overhyped, that it was a hoax, that it was no worse than the flu. And then they realized too late that the vaccine could have prevented them from serious illness. And so as a health professional, what's that like for you and your colleagues to see this happening over and over again?
Well, it's obviously very sad from a morale perspective. It nothing dampens our morale at the hospital like trying to provide good information and the public not heeding it. And so as people continue to come into our hospital, and you're correct, people that we admit to our hospital with COVID are not just people suffering from mild symptoms. They have to be admitted because they need increased level of medical care. And in fact, Duval County, out of the entire state, has a higher number of hospitalized COVID patients per 100,000 than anyone else in the state. And it's been gaining almost 100% every 2 weeks. So what that means is people here in Duval in the Northeast Florida region who are largely unvaccinated are showing up to our hospital having not heeded our advice on getting this vaccine. So right now, as numbers start to surge, we're really, really advocating get the vaccine. It works, and it will keep you out of our hospital system.
We can't say this enough. We've been saying it practically every day now since this thing began and since the vaccines were available. Please, everyone, please get vaccinated. If you have children, vaccinate them. Both of our children in my home, age 15 and 18, have been fully vaccinated, particularly since one of them is going back to high school in a few weeks, and masks will be optional in schools. The best protection we all have from hospitalization and death is the vaccine. Please get the vaccine. All right, let's go to your calls now, 549-2937, as we speak with Chad Nielsen of UF Health Jacksonville. Brittany in Orange Park. Hi, Brittany. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Melissa. I really enjoy your show, by the way.
Thank you so much.
My question was, my husband and I both got very sick with COVID in April of last year. We were some of the first few in Clay County to get sick. He works for a grocery store, and we couldn't help it. But
sure.
As soon as the vaccines came out, he got his first dose and his second dose. And when I was eligible, I went and got my first dose. But unfortunately, with our schedules and our kids and work, when he took his second dose, he got very ill, fevers. They sent him home from work saying, you know, they could not have him there. So he had several days of illness after his second dose. I couldn't risk any time off of work and not being able to take care of my kids. So I've been nervous about getting that second dose. It was due in May. So my question is, if I want to get that second dose for the vaccine, which was the Moderna, mm-hmm. Am I still able to get that second dose, or do I need to start over?
Oh, yeah.
My last dose was in April, and my second dose was supposed to be May, but I've long skipped over that.
Yeah.
Worried about getting sick.
That's a great question, Brittany, and I'm so sorry that you and your husband went through that. So what should someone like Brittany do, Chad?
Yeah, I would advise her to go ahead and get that second shot. What we have been advising folks based on CDC and actually manufacturer guidelines is to go ahead, and even if you had a long time period before your first and second dose, that's okay. You won't have to start a new two-dose series over again. Go ahead and get that second shot and inform them that you did have your first one. The other caveat to that is new OSHA requirements have officially gone into effect in that if you get symptomatic after receiving your COVID vaccine, employers have a federal responsibility to allow you time off to recover from those symptoms, and in many cases, to actually get paid. So OSHA put that guideline into effect starting July 6th with the intent that we wanted to ensure that from a federal level, employers had a responsibility to allow you to get that vaccine and not be punished if you became symptomatic after.
Brittany, I hope that helps you. And how can she show that information to her employer, Chad?
Yeah, so every employer falls under this federal guideline. Doesn't matter if they're public or private. And so if there is an issue with your employer regarding calling out of work or issues related to your COVID vaccine, I urge you to go ahead and Google OSHA ETS COVID-19. And those standards are legally binding, and they can find those online very easily to show their employers.
We'll go to a few more calls in a moment as we speak with Chad Nielsen of UF Health Jacksonville. Duval County is a hotspot for a new uptick in the spread of the virus as a Delta variant takes hold across the state. Mayor Curry is begging people to be vaccinated. Let us know your thoughts. It's 549-2937. We're getting tweets in the meantime about the campaign of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis selling merchandise labeled "Don't Fauci My Florida." This as Florida reaches coronavirus case counts that are among the highest in the nation. These are drink koozies and T-shirts that the governor's campaign team rolled out to basically take a shot at the nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci. It's a campaign narrative running on opposition to virus-fueled shutdowns and mask mandates. And so I'm wondering, Chad Nielsen, how you feel about this, the governor directly contradicting the messaging of public health experts, begging people to be vaccinated and to take precautions like wearing masks in crowded indoor spaces. Is this unhelpful?
Yeah, it's certainly not what we want to see. Dr. Fauci has largely been made a target for opposition politic purposes, which is frankly unfair. We know that Florida has become a state that others are relocating to avoid more restrictive COVID lockdowns or mandates or masking policies from around the nation. And so I think by a campaign running on that sort of fervor, it is not helpful considering that our hospitals are starting to fill with COVID admissions again. And let me be clear, just like what we saw in the pandemic surge in January and prior to that last July, when we have a surge of COVID cases into the hospital in about 10 days to 14 days, we're going to see a surge of deaths due to COVID. And so I certainly don't think anything taking pot shots at the government's top infectious disease official is going to be helpful in preventing citizens of the state of Florida from getting COVID-19 or, in fact, getting vaccinated.
Yeah, I mean, this is about death. I don't know how else to say this. You can die from this disease. You can be a perfectly healthy, young, fit person with no pre-existing conditions and die or come very close to death. Now, that said, the majority of people who've died from this virus have had either pre-existing conditions or they've been senior citizens. But Chad, the majority isn't everyone. I just don't know what else we can say to people at this point to convince them that this is serious and this is real and that we're not out of the woods yet.
Yeah, and unfortunately, this is the world that we live in right now in the United States, that politics has infected, no pun intended, every part of society and every industry. And so what I will say to people, we are noticing a shift in our hospitalization, particularly age ranges. So we are no longer just seeing most of our hospitalized patients 60 and up. It's more of a bell curve. It's more of an equal distribution of ages. So right now, 50% of our patients are less than 60 and 50% are over. So what that means is the population of people who are least likely to be vaccinated, which is those 50 and under, are showing up with COVID in our hospital. So it has shifted to a younger demographic because most of the elderly population heeded the warnings and got vaccinated, and they're not the ones in our hospital. They're not the ones who are currently going to be severely infected and show up in our emergency department. So I'm not sure we can do anything else. We will continue to educate as we have. We'll continue to spread that message of the safety of the vaccine and the efficacy. We really just have to rely on the public to heed those warnings from us and not take it from politicians who have ulterior motives.
549-2937, Mitch in Mandarin. Hello, Mitch. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I own an insurance agency here in the city of Jacksonville, and I have 12 employees, and we are in a office space, and all of them are vaccinated with the exception of one, and I have been contemplating requiring him to provide me with proof that he is COVID-free every 7 days, are bring me proof of his vaccination, and I need to know if I can do that.
Right.
If your guest can answer.
Yes, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because these workplace issues are top of mind for so many businesses. You know, Chad, here at WJCT Public Media, we still are not letting guests into the building. It's why you're on the phone. Mm-hmm. We still are requiring everyone in our building to wear masks when they're, outside of their private office space. And, you know, at the same time, of course, nobody is being mandated to be vaccinated here. And the governor has even really made that a non-starter for employers in Florida. He's even battled cruise ships over their vaccination policies. So what should employers do?
Yeah, it's a very tight line to cross right now regarding mandatory testing or vaccinations for businesses, even private. What I would tell businesses, and hats off that most of his Mitch's employees are vaccinated, what I would advise him to do is before making any changes to his mandatory vaccine or testing policies, to reach out to whoever he has on legal counsel and make sure that they're checking with the OSHA guidelines and any potential legal ramifications that could arise from the state of Florida based on that.
We should note that Tuesday, Norwegian Cruise Lines sued Florida's Surgeon General, challenging this state's barring of business from requiring proof of COVID-19 vaccinations. They are based in Miami. They want to restart cruises next month, but not unless passengers can show they've gotten the vaccine. So Norwegian filed a complaint in federal court this week, directly challenging State Surgeon General Dr. Scott Rivkees. He has the authority to enforce this so-called ban on vaccine passports. Now, the governor, of course, is saying he does not want to see businesses forcing people to do something, and that they should not be able to deny a customer a service based on their decision whether or not to vaccinate. So there are legitimate questions about the right to privacy, the right of businesses to conduct their business in the way they see fit. At the same time, we are in uncharted waters, Chad, when it comes to this kind of public health emergency.
Yeah, that's correct. Having been a cruise passenger myself many times and really enjoying it, it puts our cruise industry in really dire threat if they can't operate the way they need to in order to ensure the safety of passengers. For anybody that's ever been on a cruise ship, You may or may not know, there's basically a limited amount of medical personnel on that ship at any given time. This is less about putting unnecessary rules in place for people getting on a cruise ship and more about the cruise ships trying to protect those passengers because there are limited resources in case somebody does fall down with COVID. To say that businesses can't operate in a way to keep their patrons safe is going to be a tough challenge, and I'm interested to see what the federal courts will say about this, because it seems like the cruise ships are just acting in a manner in order to best provide a safe environment. And look, we know that even the best case scenarios, we're still seeing COVID. Several large cruise ships have done test cruises, and regardless of vaccination status or robust testing, they're still finding positive passengers, with one of the cruise ships actually flying people home from the Caribbean after they tested positive on a random test. So we know that vaccinations are going to be the biggest key, and we need to allow those businesses to operate the way they need to ensure the safety of their patrons.
Jason in Jacksonville. Hi, Jason.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question as a follow-up to a gentleman that called in earlier, having an office space of 10 individuals that are vaccinated and the fear of one individual that comes in unvaccinated. If you're vaccinated, what fears would you have about somebody coming into work that's unvaccinated? Shouldn't it be that individual that has the fears?
All right. Thanks for that. Chad.
Yeah, it's a good point. So we know that the vaccine is effective against all variants, including the Delta right now. So if I'm an employee and I know I'm vaccinated and I'm in a room with other vaccinated employees and one who is unvaccinated, I'm not going to be too fearful, because I know the vaccine works. I know that it's going to keep me out of the hospital. It's going to keep me from severe illness. And I agree that one person who is not vaccinated should be fearful, mostly by going out into the community. When we're seeing workplace exposures right now here in the hospital systems, we're not seeing them at work because we provide appropriate safety protective equipment for our folks. We're seeing them getting exposed in the community, in the grocery stores or in the restaurants, because there's no PPE usage. So if you're vaccinated, you should feel a large degree of protection and not be fearful of going about your business and doing your daily activities.
That said, that employer that called in, it sounds as though he's still concerned that his one unvaccinated employee could still infect coworkers, and breakthrough cases do happen, although, as you say, they're likely to be less serious.
Yeah, that's correct. You can still get infected with COVID if you've been vaccinated. However, you are severely less likely to end up in the hospital. When we've looked at the data across the CDC, when we have had breakthrough cases, they have not resulted in numbers of death or hospitalization near the same rate as those who are unvaccinated. And you see it every day in the media. A wedding happens in India, and five people who had the vaccine walked out of the wedding not sick from COVID, and the rest of them got COVID. You see these stories all the time anecdotally in the media because the science is there and it's true. We know the vaccine works. It's going to keep you out of the hospital even if you do get COVID.
Felix in Jacks Beach. Hi, Felix. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you. About the vaccine, and, you know, as we know, and I think Chad will agree, that it's not 100% proof that you can't get COVID. And so we have to also remember the long-term effects. So as a person, you can say, you know, I got COVID, but I'm fine now. But we don't know how you're going to be fine later on down the road, because, as far as I know, I believe COVID-19 is a vascular disease, so it affects all sorts of parts of your body. So why would we want to take a chance on that? I mean, I think a lot of people think, oh, well, I'm 17 years old, I get COVID, I got COVID, and then it lasted 2 weeks, and I'm fine. I think it's a very dangerous thing. I think you need to start talking about what this thing can do long-term. I know we don't have the data right now. Thanks.
Sure. There are long-term effects of this disease that are just now being studied. Chad, just me speaking, I'd rather get the vaccine than take a chance on the long-term impacts of having the disease.
Yeah, and Felix is absolutely right. We don't know yet the long-term effects of COVID-19. What this COVID long-hauler syndrome, as it's being called, is starting to show is that it's very misunderstood. We don't have any idea what it will look like. And what we always go back to is the fact that COVID causing a loss of taste and smell amongst people means one thing. It means it's affecting something neurologically, okay? And so if you're a healthy individual and you get COVID, or you're young and you get COVID, and you're like, well, I lost my sense of taste and smell for a little while, and it hasn't really come back, you know, and it's quite the same in 3 to 4 months, that means COVID's lingering. Something's going on there that it can affect you all over your body, and we don't have that long-term data to know what that looks like. So I absolutely agree with Felix. If anything, we need to get the vaccine to ensure these long-term symptoms aren't going to be an issue for us moving forward.
So with all of that said, if you haven't gotten vaccinated yet, what on earth are you waiting for, people? Come on. We are a hotspot again. People are getting sick again. The hospitals are filling up again. And frankly, it's because too many of you out there won't get the shot. Where do you get the shot? Any grocery store or pharmacy. Any of them. Go to any Publix, Harvey's, Winn-Dixie, CVS, Walgreens, or other pharmacy. There are others in this community offering the vaccine. Walk in, go to a Walmart. Walk in and ask to be vaccinated. Please. And thank you, Chad Nielsen, infection prevention specialist with UF Health Jacksonville, so much for being with us.
Yeah, it's always my pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Melissa.
And much more still ahead on the show later in the hour. Some positive news and notes for your midweek, but up next.
The building is on a barrier island with the Atlantic Ocean on one side and Biscayne Bay on the other. And historically, such islands moved around.
The Surfside tragedy and the vulnerability of buildings all up and down our Florida coast. That's next. Well, the investigation into the collapse of a condo high-rise in Surfside, Florida, continues this week. The death toll at the site has risen to 95 so far, with dozens more still missing. Meanwhile, reporters who cover climate change say its effects in the long term will threaten buildings all up and down Florida's coast. I spoke with journalist Oliver Millman of The Guardian. Take a listen. Hi, Oliver. Thanks for being with us. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too.
Okay, so while investigators still try to figure out what caused the condo collapse in Surfside, Florida, your reporting is interesting because it raises a larger issue. Buildings along the Florida coast of all kinds are going to be increasingly vulnerable to the effects of climate change, especially salt water that's pushing up from below to weaken foundations, as you've been reporting. What are you learning about some of these longer-term issues?
Sure. So I think it's important to say right at the start, we still don't know what caused the collapse of the building in Surfside. It's still not been determined whether climate change or its effects were a fundamental factor in that. But there certainly are several experts raising questions about the impact of sea level rise and how that is affecting structures such as Champlain Towers South, the building that did unfortunately fall in June. So essentially, the building is on a barrier island with the Atlantic Ocean on one side and Biscayne Bay on the other. And historically, such islands moved around. Native Americans never really settled them in a kind of permanent way because they would always shift around with the tides and the ocean. And it takes a certain amount of engineering to kind of fix them in place. And you see that in Miami Beach and Surfside, and you see that in Atlantic City, New Jersey. These are places that traditionally have moved around. The other issue you have, though, with some Florida is you've got an extremely low-lying landscape that is experiencing some of the highest levels of sea level rise in the world. So the sea level's risen by about 8 inches since 1915, and it's accelerating now. In some places, it's kind of an inch every 3 years. And by 2040, it's expected to be around 17 inches of sea level rise. So the sea's advancing quite quickly, and the issue in southern Florida is the limestone underneath the feet of everybody who's moved that area and lives and works and plays in southern Florida. They're standing essentially on a limestone base,
mm-hmm.
and that's what's causing the water to bubble up from underneath. It's not just a case of the water coming in from the coastline, it's coming up from underneath. And why that's an issue with buildings is obviously the foundations of buildings can be compromised if you have salt water eroding concrete and steel. That can pose an issue, and the experts I spoke to pointed out that when buildings were constructed 40 years ago, such as the building that collapsed, there were no regulations or even thoughts around such a threat. That wasn't really on the radar of those who were constructing these buildings. So that is something that the investigators will have to look into to determine whether that was a factor. We know from a report 3 years ago there were significant cracks and breaks in the concrete. Whether that was caused or was exacerbated by sea level rise, water coming up from below through that limestone, we yet to know, but it's certainly going to be an issue that Florida is going to have to grapple with in the future as seas continue to rise.
That's right. And as your reporting points out, all of those issues are coming together in South Florida in a particularly acute way. For our North Florida listeners, many of whom live on a barrier island up here that encompasses several popular beaches communities, this is an existential threat to their buildings, too, although it's a little farther out on the horizon. But what are your thoughts about people that have followed the story in Surfside, live on the coast? They are concerned about the safety of their buildings to the impacts of climate change. Even though we are talking about a time window that might be a little farther into this century than what people in Miami are dealing with and will be dealing with.
Yeah, that's right. Certain places along the East Coast are far more vulnerable than others. I think southern Florida is a kind of a severe hotspot. You had a kind of meeting that happened with the county commissioners down in the Florida Keys last month where they essentially conceded they needed to raise the streets. They needed to spend nearly $2 billion to raise the streets to keep them from flooding. And even in that case, some streets won't be able to be saved. They're going to have to grapple at some point in the future with certain areas to be surrendered to the seas. And that some places may only be accessible by boat. That obviously isn't a situation that's facing northern parts of Florida just yet. But sea level rise is only going one direction, that's upwards. So there's going to be future issues that northern parts of Florida and other parts of the East Coast are going to face. And I think we're seeing a preview of that for them with what's happening in the southern part of the state and elsewhere around the world. If you look at places like Bangladesh, there's places in China, and if you look at what's happening in Pacific Islands as well, it's quite a kind of grim story and one that should raise significant alarm wherever you live along the coast.
You know, I really do recommend people read your work and that of your colleagues in The Guardian, because you're covering this globally and you've made it such a priority. What's your message to those Florida residents who really still haven't gotten the message about this? They still don't think it's a serious concern. We are finally seeing local and state leadership in Florida really start to proactively look at these issues. That said, you know, there's also the sense that Florida's really behind the eight ball in getting serious about mitigating against the effects of climate change in this coastal state.
Yes, and I think it's probably the tale of climate change and our response to it writ large, really, is that things have got to quite a severe state, and we're only belatedly responding to it. We're only now thinking about adaptations to the way we live, to our coasts, to our infrastructure. We're still struggling to cut carbon emissions, the burning of fossil fuels, the thing that's actually causing this huge crisis. It's still a huge political fight. So we're late to the game. And unfortunately, the climate change doesn't care about that. It's going to be relentless. The laws of physics are going to keep pushing up the ocean levels. They're going to cause extreme temperatures, as we're seeing at the moment across the US West and elsewhere in the country. So we are late to this. Florida is late to this, but like you say, they are now belatedly beginning to look at the issue of sea level rise. I think in terms of people's mindset, I think it needs to change from one where if you lived in Florida, you kind of thought about a storm maybe being a threat once every few years, something you can kind of shelter and kind of huddle down and you could get through that and that would pass and then maybe you wouldn't have another storm for 5-10 years that you need to worry about. Climate change is a much more long-term, prolonged, relentless threat. It's something that's going to affect generations to come, and there's no real hiding from it. You need to confront it. And so it's going to take a determined effort from everybody, from the federal government, state levels, the individuals, and other countries' corporations in order to address it.
Thank you so much, Oliver Millman, covering climate change with The Guardian. Our digital magazine, AdaptFlorida.org, has also partnered with The Guardian on climate change coverage. Thanks, Oliver.
Thank you so much.
Well, it is a tribute to iconic American playwright, actor, and musician Sam Shepard. Shepard Fest is coming up next month in St. Augustine at Flagler College. Andrea McCook is Associate Professor of Theater Arts at Flagler, and she's on the line with a preview. Andrea, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and thank you so much for having me on.
Great to talk to you. This sounds like a lot of fun. Sam Shepard, of course, died a few years ago. He was an icon in the arts and culture world, a playwright, actor, and musician. I was lucky enough to see Sam Shepard on stage with T-Bone Burnett. Gosh, it's been almost 20 years ago now at a performance at Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago. He was just a multi-hyphenate. He could do it all.
Absolutely. And that's the thing that's just so amazing about him. And that's why we're excited about having this festival and really trying to provide something for everybody in the community, you know, whether it's theater, music, film, academic panels. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be 3 days packed full.
Full of stuff. How did Shepard Fest come into being?
That's a really great question. So Sam Shepard died in 2017, and later on in that year, I met with Rains Carr, who is my partner in this endeavor. He and I were talking about having him teach at Flagler College for us, and he was telling me how he had just finished directing God of Hell up at the Five and Dime Theater in Jacksonville, and we started talking about our love for Sam Shepard, and he said, you know, I really want to do a Shepard Festival. And I said, well, why not do it here at Flagler College? You and I are both passionate about his work. I'd been exposed to it as an undergraduate at the University of Santa Clara in theater arts, and reading his works, and then I had the opportunity to be in Ally of the Mind when I was in the graduate acting program at NYU. It had just closed on Broadway, and, you know, I've just always been passionate about Shepard, and it was obvious that Rains was too. And so it was born out of that, and we just decided to try to launch this endeavor. Originally, it was supposed to have been last August, and of course, COVID intervened, and so here we are.
Here we are. People might not realize that Sam Shepard wrote dozens of plays. He was regarded as one of the best playwrights of the 20th century. And, you know, the average person remembers Sam Shepard playing Chuck Yeager in The Right Stuff, or they remember him playing Dolly Parton's husband in Steel Magnolias. They don't remember all of his other contributions.
That's true. And it's, and when I start talking to people about Shepherd Fest, and they'll say, well, you know, Sam Shepherd, and I'll bring up one of those many roles, or Bloodline. He was on Bloodline for three seasons on Netflix. And as soon as you see his picture, or as soon as he's related to one of those film, you know, roles that he portrayed, immediately people go, oh, right, I know exactly who he is. And
yeah,
then, you know,
he played Julia Roberts' professor in The Pelican Brief.
That's right.
And boyfriend.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
He was so,
absolutely,
he was quite versatile.
Yes, he was. And his plays are really quite extraordinary. I mean, they really run the gamut from his really avant-garde work in the, you know, it early in his career in the late 60s and 70s. And then they really kind of evolved over time. And so we're really trying to capture that complex essence of him as an artist.
It's funny, while you're talking, yeah, I'm looking through his filmography. He was in The Notebook. So many movies that everybody knows, but they just might not make the connection that,
yeah,
it was him. But, you know, what do you mostly revere him as a playwright? He was an accomplished musician, too, in addition to being an actor. But it sounds as though this festival will focus particularly on his plays.
It primarily will. He was also, he was also a poet as well as a playwright. And, of course, his plays, dialogues are filled with poetic language. So, yes, I would say theater probably is the main focus. I mean, we're doing a production of the late Henry Moss, which is one of his lesser-known works. And that's going to have two performances on Friday, August 13th, and then on Saturday, August 14th. We do have several academic panels to explore, again, the complexity of him as an artist. We're also doing a reading of a collection of short stories and poems that he wrote called Hawk Moon. But we did want to bring in the musical side, and so we're doing a, kind of a tribute to him with a performance by the Wildshiners on Sunday night, which is a concert that will be held. They're a local bluegrass band and really kind of capture, again, that spirit of Shepherd. Music does run through his plays, but it runs the gamut from, you know, rock and roll through, again, this bluegrass to the Red City Ramblers music, which is sort of a combination of again, bluegrass and jazz and Celtic music. So it's hard to kind of pin him down to just one specific genre.
Yeah, he was a real polymath. The concert that I saw him do with T-Bone Burnett was sort of in that vein, as I recall. It was just a great and sort of eclectic musical experience. So it must feel good, too, Andrea, to be able to have this on the campus. I know that the pandemic has put off a lot of events or canceled them, but this will be an in-person event at the Lewis Auditorium in St. Augustine, yes?
Yep. We're doing, all of it is on the Flagler College campus. We're actually bringing in theater professionals to work with our students as well, and bringing in some local actors. So it really is going to be a kind of a blending of a number of different artists to produce the festival, to bring them together, as well as academicians.
People have several go ahead.
Yeah, no, that was it.
People have several weeks to get their tickets, yes, so they can go to your website.
Yes, so shepherdfest.com, www.shepherdfest.com. All of the information is there. Tickets are available. We do have an all-festival package that people can look,
sure,
into, or if they're interested in just single events, you know, they can do that as well.
Check it
tickets
out, everyone.
Be available at the door. Yeah,
at the door
August
as well, which
the 15th.
shepherdfest.com, August 13th through the 15th at the Lewis Auditorium in St. Augustine. Andrea McCook, professor at Flagler College. Thank you and have fun.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
And
have
in
a
moment,
day.
Some more good news for your week. We'll be right back.
Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at vickerslanding.com. Congaree & Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congaree and penn.com.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. After a long pandemic break, Caribbean countries are now welcoming cruise ships back to port. The region depends on tourism, but COVID-19 is far from over. Many locals are unvaccinated, so public health experts say cruise with caution. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
How long can an athlete perform at a high level while being an active alcoholic? On the next Fresh Air, former big league pitcher C.C. Sabathia talks about drinking heavily through 15 seasons, including his most dominating years on the mound, and about getting sober. His new memoir is called Till the End. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
The Search for 52 tells the story of a secret Cold War operation to track enemy submarines in the Pacific Ocean. But what happens when the U.S. Navy detects a mysterious signal not from a machine, but from a mammal? We'll meet the filmmakers behind a new documentary about the search to find the loneliest whale in the world. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, a new book is out examining the legacy of Florida author Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings, author of the classic tale, The Yearling. It's called The Life She Wished to Live. Here's a quick excerpt of an interview I did with book author Anne McCutcheon.
She was, as we like to say, ahead of her time, born in 1896 and determined at an early age to be a writer, encouraged by her mother, who was a bit of a stage mother. But she was talented, and she wanted more than anything to write, and to write serious literature. She started out wanting more to be a poet, and then a dramatist, and eventually a story writer, short stories and long fiction. But it took her a while to get there, because she was also determined to earn her living as a writer. And many of us who have determined to do that for ourselves, start out not as novelists or Pulitzer Prize winners, but as journalists, as newsletter writers, whatever we have, whatever offers the opportunity to put words on the page. So that's what she did after college. She worked as a publicist for the YWCA, and that led to newspaper work, and eventually she left that in order to write her serious literature.
Tomorrow's show for a longer conversation with Anne about the legacy of Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings. Well, Isaiah 117 House is a nonprofit organization serving as a haven for kids who have been removed from their homes and are waiting to be placed in a foster home. Their local Duval County chapter will be part of a national lemonade stand challenge happening in our area Saturday, all to raise funds and awareness for local foster kids. We spoke about it with their chapter leader, Danae Bunso.
We are doing lemonade stands everywhere July 17th, this Saturday, just to raise awareness for the Isaiah 117 House.
So check it out if you see some refreshing lemonade being sold around town Saturday, including a big stand at the Mandarin Chick-fil-A. Make sure to buy a glass. Speaking of lemonade, Marcus Lemonis, best known for his long-running hit show The Prophet on CNBC, is stepping up to help emerging entrepreneurs in our area through his Lemonade Foundation. His most recent grant recipient is Worthy We Cosmetics. That's a woman-owned brand run by an African-American entrepreneur here in Jacksonville. Worthy We, as in the French May We, is getting a $5,000 grant to grow their business. May We to May to Worthy We. That's very good news. And let's give a shout out to GuideWell. The company is launching Growing Resilient Communities, a statewide challenge to accelerate the development of place-based approaches focused on addressing economic disparities in underserved communities in Florida. This challenge is targeted at entrepreneurs, nonprofits, social innovators. They're asking people to submit innovative ideas to empower communities and help them become more resilient. The challenge will award a total of $100,000 in prize money, and they'll get to pitch in four regional events around the state. You can enter at GuideWell's website. Enter by August 6th. And here's some more good news. Those new advance monthly payments of the child tax credit of up to $300 per month per child start going out to your bank accounts this week. This money comes courtesy of President Joe Biden's historic American Rescue Plan.
And I believe this is, and most people I think do as well, this historic legislation is about rebuilding the backbone of this country and giving people in this nation, working people, middle-class folks, people who built the country, a fighting chance.
The American Rescue Plan expanded the child tax credit to up to $3,600 per child for kids age 0 to 5 and $3,000 per child for kids age 6 to 17. The American Rescue Plan also authorized advance monthly payments of the child tax credit through December. So you will be getting these checks all through the rest of the year, parents. And after the horrible economic crisis we've all been through, this money will help thousands and thousands of local families with kids. So that's some good news. And if you've got more good news you'd like us to add to our weekly menu, just drop us a line. And make sure to subscribe to our What's Good Wednesdays newsletter that goes out later today. And thanks so much for listening. Thanks also to producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Emails are easy. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Let us know what's on your mind. And make sure to catch our podcast. It'll be up later today across all platforms, including the WJCT app. Check that out. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow, everyone. Have a great day and get vaccinated.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.